Okay, so if you look in your books, in your little red books on page 12, it tells you about what we're going to cover tonight. And tonight's talk is, who is Jesus? And it's a good question, because Christianity and religion generally gets a bit of bad press. But what about Jesus? Who is Jesus? And who did he claim to be? Christianity is all about Jesus, all centered on Jesus. And you'll see that in the songs that the band do each week, and what we want to talk about. In an old communist dictionary, it says that Jesus was a mythical figure who never existed. And, is that true? Did Jesus exist? We're going to look a little bit at that tonight. You know, some people say about Christianity, it's not for me. It's okay for you, or it's true for you, but it's not true for me. But the reality is, what is the reality? Does Jesus really exist? And if he does, who is he and what does he say about himself? And believing in Jesus isn't a blind leap of faith. Some people think to be a Christian, you've got to be a little bit thick and take a blind leap of faith to believe it all. But actually, to become a Christian isn't a blind leap of faith. It's a small step of faith based on firm historical evidence. And we're going to look at a little bit of that now. Okay, so Jesus existed. There's evidence, historical evidence, outside of the New Testament, which proves the existence of Jesus. There's a couple of famous Roman historians. I say famous, but you've probably never heard of them. Tacitus and Suetonius were Roman historians who wrote about Jesus. They weren't Christians. They weren't trying to promote Christianity. But they wrote about Jesus because they were historians of that day, and they wrote about him. Another historian, Josephus, again, not a Christian, a Jewish historian, he wrote about Jesus. He was born in AD 37, and he said, this is one of the things he said about Jesus. He says, now, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles, that's the non-Jews. So there's historical evidence outside of the New Testament for the existence of Jesus. But what about the historical evidence in the New Testament? I just want to make that clear that you know that the Bible is a historical document. The famous atheist Richard Dawkins says it's just literature, which is a kind of a weird thing to say, because there's lots of different types of literature, and historical literature is part of it, and the Bible fits into that really well. And we're going to look at this question in particular. How do we know that the Bible hasn't been changed over the last 2,000 years? That's what people say to me all the time. Oh, I can't believe in the Bible. It's been changed. It must have been changed. Well, okay, let's look at that question specifically. Now, on page 12, you've got this little table. I'm going to explain that to you, basically. There's a number of different ways you can check historical documents for accuracy. One of those ways is this little word, this little phrase called textual criticism, and we're going to look at that briefly to see what that is. Basically, it's this. When a document is written, it's quite easy to date when a historical document is written, because the historian who writes it refers to specific things, refers to places, people's names that are alive at the time, certain events and things that go on. So if they know that a city's been destroyed, for example, in a particular year, and the historian is writing about the life and times of that city, you know that it must have been before that happened. So it's quite easy to date when a document is written. Okay, but the other thing is when the earliest copies of those documents first appear. Okay, so, the people write this history, and then the first document that they have recorded appears sometime later. So the first one we're looking at there, Herodotus on your table, it says it was written between 488 and 428 BC. And the earliest copy appears 900 years AD. That's 1,300 years time gap between the time when it was written and when the first copy was sort of found, the earliest copy, if you like. And there are 8 copies of it. So this is Herodotus' histories. I don't expect you to have read it, but you'll know a bit about it probably. Anybody seen the film 300? Nobody? Yeah, give us a wave if you've seen the film. Oh, yeah, okay, good. I was worried there. Good. The film 300, it's in here. well, not the film, you know, the details, all about it, the 300, it's real, it's based on a true story that comes from Herodotus' history. No historian doubts the authenticity and integrity of this book. Herodotus is famous. He's known as the father of history because of the way he wrote about historical events. So he's famous. And there's eight original copies of his documentation, and yet everybody relies on it totally. Another one we'll look at, Livy's Roman History, a little bit further down, written between 59 BC and 17 AD. Okay, the earliest copy appears AD 900, a time gap of 900 years, and of which there are 20 copies. Okay, 20 copies of Livy's Roman History. Again, historians do not doubt the authenticity and reliability of this book. Lots of things that we know about Romans is in here. So when you see things like gladiator, how do we know that the things that they're wearing and the types of swords and the things that they do and the names that people have and all of those types of things, how do we know that that's authentic? From things like Livy's Roman History, no historian doubts the authenticity of that. So, what about the New Testament? Written, it says in your table there, between AD 40 and AD 100. The first manuscripts, or the first copies, appear 30 to 310 years after it was written. Just let me be clear on that. So 30 years after it was written, the first copies of some of the books of the New Testament appear. Full copies of the whole of the New Testament appear 310 years. And you see there, there's more than 8 copies of Herodotus, more than 20 copies of Livy's Roman History. It says there, 5,000 Greek copies, 10,000 Latin copies, 9,300 other language copies. That's over 24,000 original documents. Now, I know what you're probably thinking. Surely there's room for mistakes there. But let me explain how textual criticism works in terms of mistakes. So if 10 of us take a really long document, a book, and we copy it out by hand for ages, 10 of us, absolutely no doubt we will definitely make some mistakes. But it's quite difficult to work out which is the true copy if you lose the original. So let's change this a little bit. Suppose 5,000, let's take this Greek, suppose 5,000 people painstakingly copy out the manuscripts of the New Testament, 5,000 people, and then you lose the original copy. Say a few hundred people make a mistake, doesn't really matter. The more people that make the copies, although you get more errors, the ability to check those errors becomes greater. So if 50 or 100 people make a mistake, you've got 4,500 people that haven't made a mistake. You've got 4,500 people that agree. Does that make sense? So if they all agree, that's easy to do. So if somebody doesn't like something and they change it or they leave it out, there's thousands of copies that agree. So to check it against the original makes it easy. One of the greatest textual critics, F.J.A. Hort, says this: in the variety and fullness of the evidence on which it rests, the text of the New Testament stands absolutely and unapproachably alone amongst ancient prose writings. In other words, it wipes the floor with any other historical document. The early church writers, Ignatius, Clement of Rome, Polycarp of Smyrna, Irenaeus, that some of you might have heard of, they were the early writers of the New Testament, and they quote parts of the New Testament, or the early writers after the New Testament was written, rather. They quote the New Testament 36,000 times, different times in their writings. Now, this is across different countries, different times, different cultures, different languages, and when you take all of those texts, they all say the same things. So this is before the internet. This isn't like somebody sending an email that you've got the original copy of. These are people that aren't connected to each other, writing all of these things, and they all say the same things. So historically, it's beyond question that it's absolutely worthy and reliable. So we know for a fact that Jesus really existed. He was fully human, and he was a real man. But was he more than that? Was he more than just an ordinary man? Was he more than just a religious teacher? And Martin's going to look at the claims that Jesus makes about himself, the things that he said.
Thank you, Stewie. That was so well done. That's called the boring bit. Does anyone say thank you for that? Thank you, Stuart. That's why I gave him that bit. I gave him that bit because I've only got one GCSE, and that was in art, and it was a C. But anyway, here's the question tonight. We're looking at who is Jesus. But that does answer two very important things for some people. For some people, that might have been a bit boring. For me, because I'm not very educated. But for some people, some of you who are really educated, that might be really important to you, that we know for a fact that Jesus existed and that we know the Bible is a massively reliable historical document. How do we know it hasn't been changed through the ages? We know very accurately that it hasn't been changed. And anyone who knows anything about anything can talk to you about it, and you can read books about it if you're interested, if you are. But he's the big deal, Jesus. We know he existed, but who is he? How come millions of people claim to have met him and that he changed their life? That's the story you'll hear of thousands of Christians wherever you go all over the world. That Jesus is alive, that he's met me, that he's changed me. How do we know Jesus is any more than just a good man? Billy Connolly said, "I don't believe Jesus is the Son of God, but I do believe he was a good moral teacher." The interesting thing about Jesus is that's the one thing he couldn't be. Let me explain why. Because of what he said about himself, Jesus was outrageously unique. When Buddha was dying, he gathered his followers around him and he said to them, "I'm not important. The important bit of my life is the teachings. Keep my teachings and look after them." With Jesus, it was the opposite. He centered everything upon himself. It wasn't his teachings that were important. It was he himself. Jesus made everything about him. He made claims that no prophet, religious leader, or historical figure has ever made. Jesus said, for instance, "I am the bread of life. Whoever feeds on me will be totally satisfied." That's a massive claim. Hardly anyone you meet is satisfied. It doesn't matter how many cars or TV sets or relationships you have. Everyone is empty. Or empty in the end. Everyone's desperate for a better holiday, a better life, a better wife, a better house, a better them. Jesus said, "If you come to me, I'll give you something which will satisfy your soul. You'll be complete." And that something is me. That's what he said. "I am the bread of life." Jesus also said, "I am the light of the whole world." The light? There's millions of people live in total darkness. The darkness of just not knowing who they are, why they're here, where they're going. Or the darkness of total depression. That Europe is going through a blues epidemic, according to all the newspapers. There's never been so many people depressed, stressed, off work, and on tablets. Never in the history of Europe. And the two worst countries in Europe are England and France. We are filled with people. Our country is filled with people who live their lives in darkness, who wake up sad, who go to bed sad. Jesus said to everyone in the world, "I'm the light. I'm the light that you need to lighten your darkness." That's a massive claim. No one ever claimed that, only him. He also said this. He said, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies." Wow. The fear of death is just the rock bottom of all humanity. You might not think about death too much, but you will one day when you get older. When the years are going past like motorway bridges and Christmases come and go too fast, then you will think about death. I know people who wake up in the middle of the night sweating. Fear of death. Jesus said, "Connect to me, you'll never die." He said to the man dying next to him on the cross, the thief dying next to him on the cross, because he cried out to Jesus for help, Jesus said, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." Jesus said, "I'm the answer to death." No prophet, no religious teacher or leader ever claimed that about themselves. But Jesus did. Jesus said this outrageous claim about himself that makes him absolutely exclusive. He said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Not like I'm one way, I'm the way. Not like I have some truth to share with you, I am the truth. Not like, come to me and you'll have a better life. I'm life itself. I'm what life is about. And if you connect to me, you'll find out what your life is about. Wow, those are massive claims. No one ever claimed that. In his teaching, he said, when talking about the kingdom of heaven, he called it my kingdom. He told people explicitly to believe in him, to come to him, to follow him. That was his regular thing. Follow me, he told people. Leave your job. Leave what you're doing with your life. Leave your fishing nets and boats and follow me personally. Not like he's a set of rules. He's some commandments. No, me. You need me in your life. You need to connect to me. Follow me. It's an amazing claim. He said, come to me, everyone who's weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Not go and see a counselor. Not get some tablets off the dock. Not go on a self-help course. Come to me with your burdens, and I'll give you the gift of rest. You'll find rest for your soul. Wow, that's a massive claim. No one ever claimed that. Lots of prophets in the Old Testament would say things like, they'd say a message, then they'd end it by saying, thus says the Lord, or this is what God says. Jesus, when he finished his sayings, just said, this is what I say. He said, truly, I say to you. And he leveled his own teaching, his own words with scripture, with the Old Testament. He'd say, you've heard it's written in the Old Testament, but I say to you this. He'd bring his own words level with the words of God. Lots of prophets have been down through the ages, leaders of religions and Jewish prophets, and they all claim to have a message from God. Jesus was the opposite. He claimed to be the message from God. He said, I am what God is saying. I am the message. He says, to welcome me is to welcome God. You can read these in the New Testament if you want. To receive me is to receive God. Me and Margaret were once in Latvia. We were sat in this woman's house chatting to her. She was a Christian, had a nice teenage son, pouring us a little cup of tea. And we said to her, tell us how you became a Christian. She said, oh, well, I was brought up in a communist family. We were taught dogmatic atheism from kids. We never saw a Christian, never went to church. We weren't allowed Bibles. Or we weren't allowed to believe in any God. We were told by the state that there was no God, and if you thought differently, you'd be in trouble. She said, so I had absolutely no concept of God whatsoever. She said, but a few years ago, my husband left me, and I was absolutely depressed. So I was suicidal. I was living in the flat trying to bring up my son on my own. She said, and one night, I just threw myself on the bed weeping, and I said, oh, if there's anyone there, help me, please. She said, and I fell asleep weeping. She said, I woke up the next morning. As I woke up, I heard this voice in my head. It said this, and she didn't know this at the time, but these are the words of Jesus. And the words said this, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in. She heard those words. Me and Margaret said to her, so what did you do? She said, I jumped out of bed and I opened the bedroom door. She said, then I went and I opened every door in the flat and I even opened the front door. And we like said, and what happened? She said, Jesus came in. She said, for some reason, as soon as I'd done that, I had peace and hope in my heart and I didn't even know why. Within a couple of days, I met a Christian who took me to a church. I found God. I gave my life to Jesus. And I've just gone up ever since. She said, can you imagine my amazement when I was given my first Bible and I was flicking through it and I read these words from Jesus. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in. That's what Jesus claims here. Jesus says, if you welcome him, you're welcoming God. I don't know whether you've ever experimented a bit. I mean, Christianity isn't all academic and stuff. It's the Alpha course is about experiments. I want to encourage you to do that. If you don't know whether there is a God or wonder if there might be, why don't you test him out? Why don't you, on your own sometime this week, if you want to, say, Lord, if you're there, I'm opening the door. If you are God, come in and prove it. Show me. Jesus made these amazing claims. He said, to have seen him is to have seen God. There's a story of a little boy who was drawing a picture in his kitchen table, and his mum said to him, what are you drawing, Johnny? He said, I'm drawing a picture of God. She said, don't be daft. No one knows what God looks like. He said, well, I will when I'm finished. And Jesus said, point blank, to have seen me is to have seen God. He also claimed to forgive people's sins. This makes him different from any other prophet. He told people that their sins were forgiven. You might think that's pretty okay, but actually, think about this. If you punch me on the nose and I forgive you, there's some logic in that. But what about if you punch me on the nose and then Stuart says to that person, I forgive you? Oh, it's got nothing to do with you, has it? He punched me on the nose. But Jesus did exactly that all the time. He met people in the street and in houses and said to them, son, daughter, your sins are forgiven. Never mind what their sins had cost other people. He acted as though he was the person mainly offended. That got him in big trouble. Religious teachers were there and they said, blasphemy, how can he say that? Only God can forgive sins. And you know what? They're right. Only God can forgive sins, but Jesus did it all the time with no apologies. Jesus also claimed to judge the world. Sometimes people think, well, Jesus got nothing to do with me. I've got nothing to do with Jesus. Not according to him. He says this, and I quote it. He says, at the end of the world, at the end of the age, when he comes again, he'll sit on a great throne and judge everyone who's ever lived. He said that he's going to decide what happens to you when your life is over. He'll decide. Wow, that's a very big claim. Again, no prophet has ever claimed that. Then there's very direct claims in Jesus' trial. He's asked directly, because he's in trouble for this. Obviously, the Jews were really angry with him because he was claiming to be equal to God. He was claiming to be the Son of God. They picked up stones to stone him on one occasion. You can read about this in the Bible, in John's Gospel. And he said, for which of my miracles are you going to stone me? They said, we're not stoning you for miracles. We're stoning you because you, though you're a man, make yourself God. Now that shows that the Jews of the day understood what Jesus was claiming. That he was claiming equality with God, to be the Son of God, to be equal to God, the Saviour of the whole world. That's very different from being a prophet or a good teacher. In his trial, the high priest said to Jesus, I command you in the name of God, tell us if you are the Son of God. Jesus said, I am, and you will see me seated in heaven in glory. Wow, there's just all bets are off. He said it. Are you the Son of God? Yes. That's what Jesus said. He also accepted worship from his disciples. When he calmed the storm, after he'd been raised from the dead, his disciples fell at his feet and worshipped him. Now for the Jew, that would be the ultimate blasphemy, to worship a man. Jesus didn't say, no, 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 don't do that, that's wrong. He said, because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who've never seen me yet believe. He accepted it. Now, what does that mean? Well, let me tell you something that it does mean. It means that Billy Connolly can't be right. Because the one thing Jesus can't be is a good moral teacher. Why? Because he claimed to be God. That's why. And just because you claim to be something doesn't mean it's right. I could claim to be Napoleon or a boiled egg. Our mental hospitals are filled with people who claim all sorts. Doesn't mean you're right. You might be a loony, but it does mean you're a loony. Or lying. Can you see that? Logically. If I stand here tonight and say, good evening, my name's Martin Ruddick, I'm God. There are only three possibilities. One, possibility number one, I actually think I'm God. I'm whack. I'm a loony. I'm a megalomaniac. I'm an egoist. I think I'm God. I'm absolutely insane. Possibility number two, I know I'm not God, and I'm deceiving you. I'm a false teacher. I'm an evil prophet. I'm a liar. That is a logical possibility. All of these three are possible for Jesus. Possibility number three, and this is the only other one. If I claim to be God, there's only three possibilities. One, I'm a liar. Two, I'm insane. Three, I'm actually right. I'm God. But they're the only three possibilities. Can you see that I can't be a good moral teacher and claim to be God? I can be a good moral teacher and say nice things, but Jesus didn't do that. Jesus claimed to be the one and only answer for you and me. The total answer for your life and happiness and future. And everybody's on earth. Wow. Is he mad? Is he bad? Or is he God? Interesting. But he's one of the three. First of all, is he mad? Well, do you know what? It's very, very hard to think of Jesus as being mad. When you see his teachings, the Western world is based on Jesus' teachings. The Western law structure is based on the Sermon on the Mount and his teachings. And you'd be very hard pushed to say Jesus was mad. You'd be also very hard pushed to say Jesus was bad. Usually, people who are false prophets and these leaders of cults and loonies are fleecing their own pockets and making themselves a fortune. Jesus had no money. He spent his time with the poor and needy. His friends were people who were outcasts from the world, prostitutes, tax collectors, people who others wanted nothing to do with. Jesus loved them and befriended them. That doesn't sound like a bad guy. Jesus healed people and did miracles for them, free of charge, and blessed them. Nothing Jesus did in his life seemed bad. His friends said he was without sin. And in his trial, the Pilate said, "This man is innocent. I want nothing to do with his innocent blood." But if he wasn't bad, and he wasn't God, wasn't mad, then there's only one possibility left to us, and that is that he was actually right. And what evidence is there to show that he really was? We'll have five more minutes, and then we're going to have a coffee break. Is that all right? Stu's going to do the last 5 minutes.
Okay, just to make that clear, if you punch Martin on the nose, I forgive you. Oh, no. Okay, so we're going to just look at some evidence. His conquest of death, that makes Jesus very different, doesn't it? Okay, so all these great people that have lived, you know, religious leaders, whoever they might be, political leaders, military leaders, whatever, are known for their amazing life possibility and the things that they do, possibly known for the way that of their death. But Jesus is different, because he was resurrected from the dead. He said he was going to be, and he was. His disciples didn't believe him, because they weren't, you know, they didn't think it was possible. They didn't really know what he was on about when he said he was going to come back. But when he did, they got an almighty shock. So here's some things around the resurrection. People struggle with it, so they find reasons why it doesn't, you know, it's not true. And that would be a logical thing to do if you don't agree with it. One of the theories is his absence from the tomb. When Jesus rose from the dead and the people went to his tomb, he wasn't there. The Jewish leaders were worried that his disciples might do something like steal the body and claim that he'd risen from the dead. So they doubled the guard to make sure that they couldn't do that. But the stone from the tomb was moved and Jesus rose from the dead. So one of the theories is that he didn't actually die. Some people claim, well, you know, he felt a bit ill after what had happened, which I'm going to explain in a minute. And in the cool of the tomb, he recovered that he didn't actually die. Well, that's not really possible because of what he'd been through. First of all, he was beaten. They punched him. They hit him over the head with a staff again and again and again. He had a Roman flogging, which isn't like, you know, like you see these films of, you know, on the high seas of some, you know, 1700s sailor getting the lash, where they whip them with a leather and that falls away as soon as they strike the person. The Roman flogging was very different. They'd put bone and stones in tied into the leather straps so that when they struck the person, because of the weight of it as well, the bone and the stone would stick in and then they would rip it off and it would tear the skin off the back. That was a Roman flogging. It wasn't like just getting lashed with leather. It was getting ploughed, they call it. They would, the bones and stones would stick in and then they'd pull it off. That was a Roman flogging. The shock of the pain killed some people that had a heart attack. They would die from it. Many people died from a Roman flogging. It wasn't something you recovered a little bit later in the cool of the tomb. Some people bled to death. After that, he was made to carry the crossbeam that he was nailed to Calvary. He couldn't do it. Historians reckon that the crossbeam would have weighed between 40 and 60 pounds, but he couldn't do it. He had such a flogging, he couldn't carry it. We know from the Bible that the Roman soldiers got somebody else to carry it for him. Simon of Cyrene was made to carry it for him. Then they nailed him to the cross through his hands and through his feet. Through his hands, probably through here, they reckon historians. And through the feet, what they would do for flogging is they'd turn the legs sideways and bend them up and then nail them through both feet. The reason for that, and then the person would be stretched out like that. Okay, the reason for that was so that you couldn't push yourself up to alleviate the pain on your hands. And what would happen is you'd actually suffocate. He was nailed and he hung there for 6 hours. Then afterwards, when they were going to take the bodies down, because they didn't want to leave the bodies up on the Sabbath, the Roman soldiers, who were trained to kill, went to make sure that all three were dead. They broke the legs of the two people that were crucified either side of him so that they would die more quickly. When they came to Jesus, they saw that he was already dead. But just to make sure, they thrust a spear into his side, up into his heart. We know from archaeology that a Roman spear, the end of it, is between 9 inches and 24 inches long. And they thrust that up into his side. It's not something you'd recover from. In John's Gospel, it says a sudden flow of blood and water came out of him. And we know medically now from death, when you die, the blood separates from the serum. It looks like water. That's what came out of him. Jesus was dead. He didn't recover later after he'd had a rest. One of the theories is that the disciples stole the body. Like I said, they couldn't have done that because there was a guard. There was a man who wrote a story about this particular element, about the tomb being empty and what happened. He was a journalist called Albert Henry Ross, and he was quite well known in his day, in the 20s and 30s, and he wrote what is a famous classic under the pseudonym Frank Morrison, Who Moved the Stone? It's a Christian classic. It's been reprinted 10 times. It's been printed. There's millions of copies sold worldwide. He wasn't a Christian. What he did was, Albert Ross set out to prove that it was wrong, because he thought, like many people do, that Jesus was a nice guy. So he focused on the last 7 days of Jesus' life to prove and write a story about this nice Jesus to just prove that he was a nice guy. But the more he looked into the evidence for the resurrection, the more he became convinced it was true, and he became a Christian and wrote that book. The second thing is his appearance to the disciples. Some people say that they hallucinated, but let's be clear what the Bible says. He appeared over 10 times to a total of over 500 people over a 6-week period. He spoke to them, he ate, he touched people. That's not a hallucination. One or two people might possibly have the same hallucination, but over a period of time, that's a theory that's gone. The third thing that's good is the fact of the immediate effect of what happened down the ages after the resurrection. In spite of intense persecution, the church grew rapidly. It's the biggest single people movement on planet Earth. Did you know that? I know you did. Yeah, it's the biggest single people movement. Sorry, is that you? Biggest single people movement on planet Earth. And I get mocked at work. Oh, Christian, yeah, but there's more of us than there is of you. My gang is bigger than your gang. That's what I will say. At work, I might be outnumbered, but not in the world. More people believe and follow Jesus than any other person on planet Earth. It's amazing. I've travelled all around the world, seen Christians, St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, nuns worshipping God, been to South America and Colombia, been to churches there, churches in South Africa, churches at St. Petersburg in Russia. All the Christians, they're all the same. They believe the same thing. They have the same experience. They say the same things about Jesus. It's the same experience. If it wasn't true, that couldn't possibly happen. How do poor people in South America have the same experience as people in Russia and South Africa and Rome and all over the world? It's the same experience. I mean, think about it logically. They're committing themselves to the same person, Jesus, and then experiencing the same changes, the same goodness, the same benefits. Countless millions of people have had the same experience over the last 2,000 years. The resurrection's amazing. Jesus had four brothers, Joseph, James, Judas, and Simon. We know that from the New Testament. And they were against him. It says in the New Testament, his family were against him. A couple of times we see that. His brother James was against him. But after the resurrection, James became one of the pillars of the church, one of the main leaders in the church, because when he saw Jesus raised from the dead, that impacted him. He went from being against him to being so for him that he was actually stoned to death for his belief later on. Josephus, who I mentioned earlier, the Roman historian, that's how we know, because Josephus wrote about James being stoned to death for his belief in Jesus Christ. After the resurrection, the impact was amazing. C.S. Lewis says this: "We are faced then with a frightening alternative. Either Jesus was and is exactly what he said, or else he was insane or something worse, like Martin said. However strange or terrifying or unlikely it may seem, I have to accept the view that he was and is God. God has landed on this enemy-occupied world in human form." That's Jesus Christ. And tea and coffee has arrived at the back in liquid form. You'd be pleased to know. Okay, we've got, in terms of the evidence, for those that you're interested, we've got a book that you can buy called The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel. It's awesome. He refers to Frank Morrison's book, Who Moved the Stone, and other things. A brilliant writer. He interviews loads of people about what they believe about certain things, you know, about the resurrection and medical evidence and all those types of things, and historians. And you can read those interviews with those people. It's a fantastic book. How much are we selling that for, Marion? £4. Okay, we've got some of them for £4. And if we run out and you want to order one, you can do that as well. So, bless you. We're going to have some music. We're going to have tea and coffee. We'll leave the food on the table so you can keep munching away at that. And then you can have your small groups. Okay, so we'll have a 10-minute break. Bless you.